The Civil War finally liberated the slaves. That's what Lincoln meant when he spoke of America having a new birth of freedom. But liberty was also one of the biggest casualties of the war, because the deepening conflict undermined many of the cherished freedoms for which both sides had taken up arms in the first place. According to Joseph Brown, the Confederate governor of Georgia,
"It seems military men are assuming the whole powers of government to themselves and setting at defiance constitutions, laws, state rights, state sovereignty, and every other principle of civil liberty. I fear we have much more to apprehend from military despotism than from subjugation by the enemy."
Both North and South breached traditional liberties on a revolutionary scale. They suspended habeas corpus, allowing arrest without trial. They imposed martial law on civilians in war areas. And they enacted the first conscription laws in American history. The draft, as it was called, aroused particular resentment because rich people could find loopholes, such as paying for exemption or hiring a substitute. Private Sam Watkins of Tennessee had volunteered at the start of the war. He was furious when he heard of the South's Conscription Act.
"From this time till the end of the war, a soldier was simply a machine. All our pride and valor had gone, and we were sick of war and the Southern Confederacy."
Even more infuriating was the law exempting from the draft men who owned more than 20 slaves. Officially, this was to prevent anarchy on plantations with large numbers of blacks, but it enabled rich Southern boys to avoid military service.
"It gave us the blues. We wanted 20 Negroes. Negro property suddenly became very valuable, and there was raised the howl of rich man's war, poor man's fight."
Lincoln's conscription law for the North, enacted in March 1863, also had its loopholes. J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and John D. Rockefeller were among those who bought themselves out of military service for $300 and used the war to build their fortunes. Rockefeller, aged 21 when the war started, made huge profits selling grain to the Union armies and then used that money to move into the oil business. The Civil War began his rise to become the richest man in America. The inequities of the draft law provoked a backlash across the North.
"We are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more."
Protesters sang this parody of a popular recruiting song.
"Since poverty has been our crime, we bow to the decree. We are the poor who have no wealth to purchase liberty."
New York's Irish community had provided much of the cannon fodder for the Northern armies, and after the Battle of Gettysburg, the city exploded. Mobs burned draft offices, beat up anyone well-dressed who looked like a $300 man, and sacked the homes of well-known abolitionists. Above all, they turned their rage against the blacks, for whom, it seemed, the war was now being fought. A crowd converged on the city's asylum for coloured children on Fifth Avenue, near where the New York Public Library now stands. Most of the crowd was Irish, but it was also Irish police and firemen who risked life and limb to carry 20 black orphans to safety. A local journalist watched in horror.
"It hardly seems credible, yet it is nevertheless true that there were dozens of men, or rather fiends, among the crowd who gathered around the poor children and cried out, 'Murder the damned monkeys! Wring the necks of the damned Lincolnites!' Had it not been for the courageous conduct of the parties mentioned, there is little doubt that many, and perhaps all, of those helpless children would have been murdered in cold blood."
Over 100 people died in the New York draft riots of July 1863. There were disturbances on a smaller scale from urban Chicago to rural Vermont. It all served to remind Lincoln, if reminder were needed, of the grinding war weariness. In 1864, the North's armies could not finish off the enemy, even though the killer commanders were now face to face. General Ulysses S. Grant, promoted to head the Union armies, slugged it out in Virginia against Robert E. Lee, desperate to destroy Lee's army, but unable to deliver the death blow. Grant was sure that the Confederates were on their last legs and would succumb to a final push. Like Lee at Gettysburg, his confidence was hubristic and his men paid a high price. Near a little crossroads called Cold Harbour, Grant threw his men across open ground against the Confederate trenches. Unlike their commander, the troops could see what was coming. General Horace Porter, one of Grant's aides, noticed...
Many of the soldiers had taken off their coats and seemed to be engaged in sewing up rents in them. This exhibition of tailoring seemed rather peculiar at such a moment. But upon closer examination, it was found that the men were calmly writing their names and home addresses on slips of paper and pinning them on the backs of their coats, so that their dead bodies might be recognized upon the field and their fate made known to their families at home.
7,000 Union soldiers fell at Cold Harbor, mostly in the first few minutes. Grant admitted in his memoirs,
"I have always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made. No advantage whatever was gained to compensate for the heavy loss we sustained."
In 1864, amid the bloodbath, Lincoln was running for re-election. His Democrat opponent was General George McClellan, sacked by Lincoln in 1862 for his caution. Anti-war elements in the Democratic Party even managed to insert a peace plank in their campaign platform.
"Justice, humanity, liberty, and the public welfare demand that immediate efforts be made for a cessation of hostilities."
The Democratic platform wasn't a total surrender. It insisted that the United States must be reunited as part of the final settlement. Southern independence was not an option. And McClellan himself disavowed the peace plank entirely. But these were signs of mounting Northern disenchantment at what now seemed like a war without end. In August 1864, Lincoln told a friend bleakly,
"You think I don't know I am going to be beaten, but I do. And unless some great change takes place, badly beaten."
But although Lincoln didn't know it, the South was now on its last legs. The North had more than double the population, 22 million to 9 million, and it was home to 4/5 of America's industry. With its more developed fiscal and banking systems, it imposed the first income tax in US history, issued the first paper currency, known as greenbacks, and created what became a Board of Internal Revenue. The Northern war effort was almost self-sustaining, whereas the South relied heavily on imports from Europe. Gradually, the Northern blockade of Southern ports began to bite, the Southern railroad network collapsed, and roaring inflation made the currency worthless. Acute shortages of food sapped morale behind the lines and at the front. George Eggleston, a Virginian, fought in the Cold Harbor campaign, subsisting like the rest of his unit on a cracker a day and a slice of pork, which they nibbled raw because cooking would have entailed some waste. 20 years later, he had not forgotten.
"Hunger to starving men is wholly unrelated to the desire for food, as that is commonly understood and felt. It is a great agony of the whole body and of the soul as well. It is unimaginable, all-pervading pain, inflicted when the strength to endure pain is utterly gone. It is a horror which, once suffered, leaves an impression that is never erased from the memory. And to this day, the old agony of that campaign comes back upon me at the mere thought of any living creatures lacking the food it desires."
Civilians, too, were suffering. The Northern general, William Tecumseh Sherman, told his wife that Southern women now burned with deep anger towards the Northerners.
"No one who sees and hears them but feels the intensity of their hate. Not a man is seen. Nothing but women with houses plundered, fields open to cattle, servants all gone, and women and children bred in luxury, beautiful and accomplished, begging with one breath for the soldier's ration, and in another praying that the Almighty will come and kill us."
By 1864, Northern generals were waging total war, designed to break both the Confederate armies and their home front. In Georgia, Sherman besieged the city of Atlanta ruthlessly for months, and it eventually fell at the beginning of September 1864. Sherman told the city council to evacuate Atlanta. To stop it supplying the Confederacy, the city was to be totally destroyed.
The use of Atlanta for warlike purposes is inconsistent with its character as a home for families. There will be no manufacturers, commerce, or agriculture here. War is cruelty, and you cannot refine it. You might as well appeal against the thunderstorm as against these terrible hardships of war. They are inevitable. And the only way the people of Atlanta can hope once more to live in peace and quiet at home is to stop the war.
But, he assured the City Council of Atlanta,
my dear sirs, when peace does come, you may count on me for anything. Then I will share with you the last cracker.
After burning Atlanta, a scene immortalized in the movie Gone with the Wind, Sherman marched across Georgia to the sea, his soldiers carving a swathe of systematic destruction 20 or 30 miles wide that Southerners never forgot or forgave. A local woman, Eliza Andrews, recorded her horror.
We struck the burnt country, as it is well named by the natives, and then I could better understand the wrath and desperation of these poor people. I almost felt as if I should like to hang a Yankee myself. The fields were trampled down, and the road was lined with carcasses of horses, hogs, and cattle that the invaders, unable either to consume or to carry away with them, had wantonly shot down to starve out the people and prevent them from making their crops. The stench in some places was unbearable. Every few hundred yards we had to hold our noses or stop them with the cologne Mrs. Elsie had given us, and it proved a great boon. The dwellings that were standing all showed signs of pillage. Well, here and there, lone chimney stacks, Sherman's sentinels, told of homes laid in ashes.
Sherman's victory at Atlanta electrified Northerners. It transformed the election campaign and helped Lincoln win a landslide victory. In the South, by contrast, the mood was grim. Mary Chestnut, who'd watched the first shots of the war from her rooftop in Charleston, South Carolina, wrote in her diary,
since Atlanta fell, I have felt as if all were dead within me forever. We have but two armies, and Sherman is between them now. The reserves, as somebody said, have been secured only by robbing the cradle and the grave. The men too old, the boys too young. The end has come. No doubt of the fact. We are going to be wiped off the face of the earth.